whether you're department stores, whether you're a specialty retailer, whatever it might be, what are you going to do differently? And I would just say, particularly if you're successful, there's always somebody who's coming after that business. Bezos says your margin is my opportunity. I don't think that it's that. I think your mediocrity is my opportunity. If somebody's not meeting customer needs in a profound way, those customers are going elsewhere. And if the only way you can get them back is to keep discounting, you probably have a problem.
Welcome to Retail Gets Real, where we hear from retail's most fascinating leaders about the industry that impacts everyone, everywhere, every day. I'm Bill Thorne from the National Retail Federation, and on today's episode, we're talking to retail expert, author, and fellow podcaster, Steve Dennis of Sagebury Consulting. We're going to talk to Steve about his career journey, his book, Remarkable Retail, and what it takes to win and keep customers in the age of digital disruption. Steve Dennis, welcome to Retail Gets Real.
Well, thanks, Bill. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And I want to start by just asking you, tell us a little bit about your background, your career history, and why retail?
Well, I often say what a long, strange trip it's been, because it was not especially linear. It was, when you get to the fork in the road, take it kind of career. So after I got out of business school, I spent a little bit of time at a big consulting firm doing strategy consulting. Then I spent a few years in the CPG world, basically doing new product development, strategic planning, things like that. And then I decided I needed to get out of there. And at the time I was living in Chicago, and my wife had a really great career at Kraft Foods. So I wasn't going anywhere geographically. And along came this opportunity, so this is the early 90s, 91, to join Sears Roebuck and Company.
Oh, wow.
In a kind of an internal consulting group, for lack of a better term.
Right.
And I felt it was a good application of my skills. Seemed like an interesting group. I felt like Sears, of course, this ends up being pretty obvious years later, but Sears was in need of some new thinking. And so I went for it, and I was there 12 years. I actually counted it up this morning because I always forget. I had 8 different roles in those 12 years, and I basically moved back and forth from kind of general management to marketing strategy kind of roles. I eventually headed up what we at the time called multi-channel integration. This is way back in 1999, so I'm often amused by all the talk about omnichannel today as if it's kind of a new thing we should look at. And then I got promoted to head of corporate strategy, which some people have told me sounds like an oxymoron when it comes to Sears. And so it was a great variety, worked in hard lines and soft lines across a lot of different formats, e-commerce in the early days. And then I moved down to Dallas, where I am now, to join the Neiman Marcus Group as their chief strategy officer. And while I was there, I got more responsibilities for customer insight, loyalty marketing, a few other things. And then 15 years ago, I made the decision, or I guess it's more like 14, to go out on my own as a strategy and innovation consultant. That has morphed over time to my doing more writing, keynote speaking, writing a book, as you mentioned, and launching a podcast. So kind of this retail renaissance man, I guess, either that or I have a very poor ability to focus.
No, you are a retail person. I mean, retail people move around a lot, and they do a lot of different things, and they challenge themselves and the others around them to always think about change and how to change and what makes sense in changing and how does that serve the consumer. So you're doing all the right things. Sears was my first credit card I ever got.
Was a
Sears
card. Yeah.
And I still have it, a member since 1983. But I still keep it because I'm very proud of it. It was, and the brand itself. I mean, I remember growing up and, those dad admonitions. My dad's admonition was never buy a tool unless you buy it at Sears.
Yeah.
Because if it breaks, you can always take it back. Craftsman tool.
Yeah. For people of a certain generation, there are these really warm feelings about Sears, not only as a store that maybe, their parents took them to get their school clothes or the first credit card, or they love tools, or they got a Kenmore appliance in their first place, or those kinds of things. So yeah, a lot of times when I'm talking to people that are younger and are kind of like, what the heck is this Sears thing? It's pretty stark contrast.
Yeah. Now you mentioned early on, and I may be totally off on this, I believe that I read somewhere that Sears really was the first. I mean, did Sears offer the ability to buy product online at any point in time?
Yeah,
I mean, weren't they one of the first?
Yeah, they were. It's kind of funny because, I think Sears, I'm not 100% sure of this, but I believe Sears was the first retailer to pass $100 million in online sales, which was probably about 1998.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Now, Amazon zoomed past us pretty quickly, and Walmart, I think, got to a similar level. But it's kind of funny in a way, and this is probably a whole separate episode, but Sears was actually quite aware and did a decent amount of experimenting. You know, even when I talk about my role as VP of channel integration, sometimes in my keynotes, I will put this quote up without saying who it's from. And I ask the audience to say, you know, who said this and when? And the quote is something like, "The future of our brand will be determined to meet our customers' needs anytime, anywhere, anyway." You know, which today we look as a very seamless commerce, whatever you want to call it. Well, the answer is Arthur Martinez, who was the CEO of Sears, and that was February of 1999. Mm. And so it was very clear, and I, as I mentioned, got this role to figure out how we were going to leverage e-commerce and physical together. And so to me, it's still funny when I hear companies talking about, oh, it's really important that we put all this stuff together. I'm like, guys, we were working on that, you know, more than 20 years ago. And when I got to Neiman Marcus and I had responsibility for what we called multi-channel, you know, that was also what we were very focused on. And, you know, that's 15, 16, 17 years ago. So a lot of this stuff is not new. It's just interesting why it's taken so long for people kind of to wake up to it.
You know, it's really interesting. I had a conversation very early on when it started at the National Retail Federation, and we had a group of communicators together at a meeting, and we were talking about omnichannel and some of the challenges. And one of the folks that was there from an unnamed brand said, you know, the biggest challenge that we've had is recognizing that we're all the same, because they were having people come into the store and say, hey, I want to get that red dress that I saw online because I want to get it. I need to wear it tonight. And they're like, well, we don't have red dresses. That was amazing.
Well, I think to me, one of the principles, and I'm actually working on a second book now, and one of the things I talk about, we'll see what makes it in, but one of the things I say is, you know, a pretty basic thing if you're going to innovate is to pay attention. You know, we talk a lot about being customer centric. And to me, it's like, if you were paying attention to what customers were saying and doing, it would be quite obvious that this idea of channels, customers don't think about channels. Mm-hmm. I always say the customer is the channel.
Right.
You know, we have to be session aware, or, you know, have the context. It's easy for me to say, but I know pulling this all together in a harmonious way is not so easy.
Right.
But it's very clear. I mean, we did a ton of research at Neiman Marcus. I mean, we kind of knew this anecdotally at Sears because people would come in to our appliance department in particular, having printed out spec sheets and saying, hey, I'm trying to decide whether I want gas or electric, or why should I pay more for the KitchenAid, or whatever it might be. So it's pretty clear that was a behavior that was really apparent 20 plus years ago.
Right.
But at Neiman's, we did a lot of deep dives and to see the interplay between digital and physical. And it was very clear people, that digital was driving store experience and that stores were driving digital. And even when we had customers that were in the same trade area, you know, lived very close to the store, a fair percentage of those customers were choosing to shop online.
Yep.
So to me, this behavior has been really, really apparent. And it's not clear to me why it would be that different, you know, at Neiman Marcus. And in fact, I've talked to people 20 years ago at Williams-Sonoma and a bunch of other, particularly the catalog, the brands that started a mail order catalog. And they were like, yeah, we open stores where we have a good catalog business. And what we see is that our cataloger now, you know, then online business goes up when we open that. And when we close stores, our online business goes down. So I really don't it's interesting to me. I don't know if it's cultural blindness or an internal focus or just that retailers aren't doing enough of that work to really see what's going on.
Yep. Well, if they're going to be successful, that's an absolute consideration moving forward because the consumer expects it. So now your book is titled Remarkable Retail: How to Win and Keep Customers in the Age of Disruption, which goes right in line with what we've been talking about thus far. So tell me what you mean by remarkable retail, and what do you consider the age of disruption?
Yeah. So the premise of the book, I sometimes will say, and this doesn't work as well, we talk about age differences, but in recent keynotes, I've been starting with the slide that says, set the Wayback Machine for 1995. And, some people get the reference and others don't, but it's the idea of thinking about what retail was in the mid 90s and what made for a successful retailer. And for the most part, with, the small mail order business being the exception, successful retailers leverage a really great location, great visual merchandising, great curation of the assortment, salespeople, reputation in the community, all these things. But pretty much all of retail involved a customer going someplace to see what was on offer, maybe getting some sales help, paying for it, hopefully, and taking it home. That was what retail was about.
Right.
But once e-commerce and digital technology in general came to pass, suddenly those elements of competitive advantage started to shift because you could get access to just about any product in the world. You could get information about pricing and what products you should get. The internet never closes. So if you want to buy something at 3 a.m, that's available to you. The ability to connect with other people or brands and have a sharing economy and all that. So over time, we basically saw and continue to see 2+ decades of really seismic shifts on the things that drove success in retail. Yep. It's not the only effect, but I think the biggest effect is what I call the collapse of the middle. So if you were, and I'm not going to name too many names here, but if you were a retailer that was based on having a massive assortment that you had to go to see, and price was important, the internet turned out not to be your friend. So now, if you were more value or convenience-based, one end of the spectrum, or you had really unique experience, great customer service, differentiated product, or whatever, the internet, for the most part, facilitates sales. It doesn't necessarily right. compete directly. Now, I always point out that when we look at some of these retailers that have gotten into trouble, absolutely nothing prevented them from having great websites. Like I say, you can't blame... There's very few retailers you can blame their troubles on Amazon. Like almost anything Amazon can do, they could do pretty well if they chose to, and they were just slow to react. So in this world of abundant choice and anytime access, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, being very good is no longer good enough. That's my fundamental premise, that you have to be truly remarkable. And by remarkable, I mean kind of the common way things people think about it, differentiated, unique, special. But in particular, I mean it the way that Seth Godin talks about it in his book, Purple Cow, which is you literally give people something to talk about, to remark upon, because that's also the quality that gets you high net promoter scores, sure. kind of the thing that captures that. But that you have such a strong emotional connection with the customer that loyalty is cemented and it doesn't be about that 15% coupon or whatever. And because they'll tell their friends about it, your brand will be enhanced and you'll get that viral effect. So that's the essence of remarkable. And then, disruption continues to be something that continues to happen. And I would argue in many cases, it's happening at an accelerating rate. So if you don't aim higher in the value you're delivering for customers and differentiate yourself from the competition in a material, sustainable way, and you don't move more quickly, chances are you're falling further and further behind. And there's ample evidence of this having been true and continuing to play out.
Yeah. And speed is friend for retail or a very, very bad enemy of retail. If you can't get it done quickly, then you're behind. I mean, because everything's moving so quickly. That's another question that I have for you, Steve. I mean, we went through, the pandemic, the shutdown, people online, people doing... And the brands responding to that, the brands doing things that normally would take 6 months to roll out, a year to roll out, they're basically rolling out in 2 weeks, if not shorter. And I talked to a lot of our brand leaders during that time on the podcast and, personally. And I was really struck by how excited they were about the fact that they were able to do this. And especially the technologists, they're like, yeah, I went into a meeting and I said, we should set up this ambassador program. And the next thing I know, we're rolling out the ambassador program. So do you think that has their stickiness there? Is that the future?
Well, one of the things I make a big point of in Remarkable Retail is talk about this idea of building a culture of experimentation and testing and learning. I think that has been a fabulous idea for a long time. I hope, though, I will say, maybe because I'm fundamentally a cynical person or because I've been doing this a long time, that I don't know that some of the behavior that we've seen or that we saw during the depths of COVID will continue. I mean, it actually makes me crazy. And we've talked about this on my podcast as well as in the book. And I often talk about it when I speak or with clients. Why does it take a crisis for you to innovate?
Yeah, really?
I don't understand when people are like, well, we rolled out buy online, pick up in store and, you know, 4 weeks. I'm like, fantastic. I can give you 100 retailers that rolled it out 10 years ago. You know, why? I mean, to me, if there are things, just to be, I guess, a little bit more provocative, perhaps to make a point, some of these CEOs, I don't know why the board didn't fire them. Because if these were good things to do and the evidence was overwhelming that it gave your competitors advantage 10 years ago, then you aren't qualified to do that job. That is, there's a fundamental problem in the way you approach innovation. Now, there are things that were related to safety. That's different.
Right.
But buy online, pick up in store, buy online, return to store is not on them. You can go back and look at stuff that I was writing about over a decade ago about that, as well as plenty of others. So we'll see. I mean, you know, it is hard. I think fear of failure is, to me, the most powerful force. This book I'm writing on transformation and innovation, I'm spending a lot of time on how leaders need to slay the dragon of fear or the resistance, as an author many people might know, Stephen Pressfield, talks about. And I think that's the thing. And when the fear becomes your business is going to go, you're going to go out of business or really be in trouble if you don't respond, you know, that's the motivating factor. But you have to find out how to have that sense of urgency in more normal times.
Right, totally.
Sorry, that was a little ranty, but...
No.
I
think it's great.
Sort of crazy.
No, you're exactly right. And to your point, a lot of those innovations weren't really innovations. They were just, it was the way that you needed to do business at a time of crisis. So retail right now, how do you describe the state of retail in 2023?
To me, it's in flux, I guess, is one way to look at it, or highly volatile and uncertain. One of the things we often talk about on my podcast, and it's just kind of funny because we've been doing it for about 2.5 years. I would say about half the time we end up commenting on something related to macroeconomics, talking about supply chain or interest rates or whatever. And having been doing this a long time, and even, you know, been the chief strategy officer at two companies, I didn't pay a lot of attention to interest rates and supply chain when we were formulating our strategy. So we've gotten into this world, you know, largely by virtue of COVID and some of the things that manifested out of that, where it's pretty hard to know how to operate. Who is a CEO or part of a senior team that has really lived through, you know, in a leadership role, lived through high inflation, lived through extraordinarily low unemployment at the same time? You know, I think things like supply chain and others are, you know, are mitigating, but there's so many of these external forces. And even when you look at the consumer behavior, I think it's pretty easy to say that some of the great sales performance that we've seen is a result of stimulus payments. It's the result of people not spending as much time at work, so they've got more discretionary income. So I think it's pretty well proven. But to know, as you know, we settle into a little bit more of a familiar territory, how that's going to affect consumer spending,
right,
and how long inflation can be at a pretty high rate. And I don't think inflation is going to come down as fast as some people are saying. So we'll see. It's just hard to navigate, you know? And so I think the main lesson, which I think was also probably a good idea before the pandemic, was how do you build more agility into the way you operate? I mean, I think that's the main thing. One of the quotes I have in my book is from a meditation teacher, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who says, "The waves are going to keep coming. You better learn how to surf." And I think that's a great metaphor for the way retail is going to be, at least for, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think the waters, or whatever metaphor we want to use, are going to be pretty choppy for a couple of years at least.
I think that the challenge for retailers, and particularly in the leadership, is, to your point, I mean, the macroeconomic issues, its impact on the psyche of the consumer, how they're going to react. And all of the uncertainty around that, if you allow yourself to then kind of create this, and you mentioned it earlier, this kind of this atmosphere of fear, you know, what if I do this, is it the right thing to do? Because we've never done that before. I think that you've just got to kind of buckle in and say, we're going to go forward because this is what we believe is the best thing to do for the consumer that shops our stores or buys online. And we're just going to do it. And it may be a noble failure, but yeah, it's the right thing to do at the time.
I think so. I do think, though, it depends a lot on what we're talking about. Because on the one hand, yes, build in a lot of agility, do your scenario planning, be doing a lot of experimentation. But there are times where you just kind of have to go for it. Like I think about, I don't know, Nebraska Furniture Mart, if people are familiar with that, or they're not so new anymore, but when Restoration Hardware, now RH, opened their galleries, I mean, there was a point at which I don't think you could really test building that. You know, I'm sure there's pieces of it that were tested along the way, but you know, at a certain point, you've got to spend the money right, to build this thing for real. It's very hard to simulate, and I wouldn't trust consumer research as being particularly helpful in evaluating that sort of thing. So, but I think it's about picking your spots and having, I think the companies that are the best at innovation, they have a portfolio approach to what they're doing. You know, they have near-term things, right, they have bigger bets. I kind of hate talking about the metaverse, but you know, I think as relates to the metaverse, I don't know what, I mean, I think there's plenty of promise there. I don't think it's going to be a big thing for most retailers anytime soon, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be spending some time trying to understand it better,
correct,
maybe doing some pilots and things like that. So there's a little bit of this black and white thinking, all or nothing, that goes on in a lot of retailers still. And I think that's a real barrier to progress.
So in your book, you say omnichannel is dead, and you argue for this term hybridization and harmonization.
Right.
And you don't try that after a few beers. I'm telling you, that'll never, ever, ever work. But right, what does it mean? What does that mean?
Right. Well, I'm required by law as a consultant to make up my own terms to say sometimes the same thing as other people are saying. So I will admit to being guilty of that sometimes. Well, this joke I've told too many times now, so I'm sure there's somebody in the audience who's heard it, is I only have two problems with omnichannel, the omni and the channel.
Right.
And I say that because, you know, if you take it literally, and I think the way it's played out or was playing out at a lot of retailers was, it was kind of everybody out for a pass. You know, we got to be everywhere, wherever the customer is, we need to be. And I think that's just nuts. There's very few cases where sort of that one size fits all, kind of spreading the peanut butter, or whatever phrase you like, makes sense. I think it's about successful strategies, about showing up where it really matters in remarkable ways. And so omni is not a term that I think is super helpful. I mean, does that mean you have to be on cruise ships or pop-ups or, I mean, airports? I just think it's not helpful. And then channel is really problematic. I mean, the single biggest, I can point to many, many companies who stuck, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier about silos belong on farms. The companies that really thought about e-commerce and physical stores as separate things very consistently made the wrong decisions for their customers and financially. So you really got to get this channel language out of there. So the way, what I mean by harmonized is, and I like kind of the evocative nature of the word. I think it's, you know, just like a great piece of music, you know, pulls together all the instruments for the piece to sing beautifully. And sometimes, you know, it's low, sometimes there's crescendo, you know, there's a rhythm to the whole thing. And customer journeys and different competitors, what a great experience, remarkable experience, whatever looks like, can be quite different. But our job is to try to orchestrate all the pieces to resolve the discordant notes, just to play out the musical analogy a little bit more, and sort of amplify the wow in the experience. And I think as you think about how to deliver this harmonious experience, understanding customer journeys, doing a friction audit or whatever you want to call it, super important. But you've got to find those one, two, three things where you can really differentiate yourself. The hybridization part of it is newer. I've been talking about harmonized retail for a while. Hybridization is newer because I think the other thing that's happening, and again, it gets a little bit back to this kind of channel-centric, but also one-size-fits-all format strategy. You know, most of the stores, the big chains, have essentially the same format everywhere. You know, they roll out a prototype maybe a few variations for urban or what have you. But I think what we're going to see, and we're starting to see from players like Best Buy, is really reconfiguring your market strategy. So you have multiple formats, or for example, Target, where they're leveraging stores to be e-commerce fulfillment and delivery pickup sites, and they're creating these sortation centers in the market. Right. So it's coming at very much at it from the customer point of view. What are the different customer jobs to be done? Or shout out to Clayton Christensen. I love that approach. And then configuring your assets and your operating model to be more responsive. But it is fundamentally about, we live in this blended digital physical world. And sometimes customers want to go get something at the store, but have it thrown in their trunk.
Right.
Sometimes they want to go in and wander around. So you really have to understand it and then start to shift that. I think the hardest problem really, even if you can understand the customer journeys, is for legacy retailers, you know, they've got so much real estate tied up in a model that basically doesn't work in the future. And so that's a tough thing to navigate. But, you know, the sooner you start at it, the better you'll be.
I've been on this crusade for a long time to get rid of omnichannel. I hate that description of retail. It's all one thing, really, at the end of the day.
Right.
Whether you buy it online or you buy it in store, it comes to the bottom line of the company, of the business, of the brand. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, it's all just, a number of people have said, Jason Goldberg and others, it's all just commerce, right? It's all just retail. And these distinctions, I mean, they have some importance. I mean, I think you have to be aware of what the customer is trying to do and where they're doing it from, sure, and be able to respond to that. And certainly it's worth understanding the unique requirements of certain types. I mean, there are some customers that only shop for certain products online.
Sure.
You need to figure out how to do that well, and people that are store dominant. So there are nuances to it, but the overriding issue is to really be channel agnostic and think about it all as kind of one branded experience, really. It's the brand that customers care about ultimately. And most customers are active. I mean, there's very few customers that are, you know, store only or online only. You know, usually there's this interplay that's important.
Sure.
And, you know, that's just growing.
Yep. So the future of retail, what excites you the most?
Well, in general, I love retail because it's so dynamic. You know, never a dull moment, I feel like. So that always keeps me interested. We're in this period of flux where it's going to be confusing in a lot of respects for a little while until some things sort out. I think that some of the pressures on weaker players, my hope is that they're going to be able to take the action that they need to right the ship and get on a better trajectory. Generally speaking, I think that is pretty hard to do. I think it's harder and harder when you get further behind.
Yeah, for sure.
To catch up. You touched on that earlier. Most retailers that are struggling are probably not going to get a lot of help from the economy for a little while. You know, tons of headwinds, rising interest rates, these kinds of things. So that's kind of depressing, I have to say. But then I see plenty of retailers that really have a compelling value proposition, that are investing in both their physical and digital capabilities, that are doing the stuff we just talked about, pursuing this more hybrid approach, taking a look at their format strategy, that are doing great.
Yep.
So I'm really interested in both keeping the pedal to the metal on the innovation and then hoping that some of the companies that really need to change won't stop doing what I often talk about as this kind of slightly better version of mediocre strategy, that they really understand that they've got to differentiate themselves much more and they have to move much more quickly. But that's, again, easier said than done, unfortunately.
It is, but it is retail. I think it's as critical as anything is just basically staying in front and always looking for ways to keep that momentum going. And it's when you stop, all of a sudden you realize everybody else has moved forward and you're just playing catch up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, unfortunately, there are a few of them. And the thing, and you know, this is probably not the most helpful comment, but I often come back and say, and you know, this was a lot of my experience at Sears, but now I see it being an analyst and looking at what other companies are doing is, why did you watch the last 20 years happen to you?
Right.
We can point to a number of very famous brands that are,
for sure,
well, in some cases have basically gone away, were in serious trouble, and very little of what got them into trouble is something that happened overnight. You know,
right?
If they're paying any attention, they would see that they're losing. Like, I'll make a quick comment. If you look at Ulta, which I think is a tremendous company, Ulta, you know, is only in the beauty category. They are now, I forget the exact number, but it's in this vicinity. Their market value now is like $25 billion, I think, just in the beauty category. 20 years ago, when Ulta was teeny tiny, the beauty category was dominated by major department stores.
Sure. Right?
Overwhelmingly. Macy's, JCPenney, Kohl's, and Dillard's combined are worth about what Ulta is worth. So you have this tremendous value migration just in beauty. Forget apparel, all these other things. I mean, those department stores, like beauty's their whole business, right?
Right.
So for a company to steal that much share from the department stores and be more valuable as a specialty retailer than all of them combined.
Yeah.
And it's not a secret. It didn't happen overnight.
Right.
So I think in defending the status quo, in protecting the real estate assets, I mean, that's a lot of what I experienced at Sears and I've experienced with some clients. And now the question is, okay, that's where you are, right? So whether you're department stores, whether you're a specialty retailer, whatever it might be, what are you going to do differently? And I would just say, there's always somebody who's going to, particularly if you're successful, there's always somebody who's coming after that business. Bezos says, your margin is my opportunity. I don't think that it's that. I think your mediocrity is my opportunity.
For sure.
You know, the margin's, you know, an indication maybe, but it's really, if somebody's not meeting customer needs in a profound way, those customers are going elsewhere.
Yep.
And if the only way you can get them back is to keep discounting, you probably got a problem.
Yep. All right. Last question, I promise.
Sure.
What is the best piece of career advice you've ever given or received? Or is it the same?
They're probably similar. I mean, one of the things I like is just this idea that this too shall pass. Like, I have found myself, as well as people who've worked for me, that just get all worked up about something in the moment. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, that just takes us away from what we need to do. Related to that is this guy, Eckhart Tolle, who says, the problem is not the problem. The problem is you're thinking about the problem.
Mm.
And I think that's maybe a little bit more woo-woo or spiritual than you were pointed to. But I just think we oftentimes can just take things personally.
Sure.
Or assume that a bad situation is going to be that way forever. And there's no reason. I mean, life can be tough enough. There's no reason to beat ourselves up about things that are outside of our control or really pretty ephemeral.
Amen. Steve Dennis, it has been a real honor and pleasure talking with you. And so thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure as well.
And thank you all for listening to another episode of Retail Gets Real. You can find more information about this episode at retailgetsreal.com. I'm Bill Thorne. This is Retail Gets Real. Thanks for listening.